Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another special interview episode from Media Monarchy. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show MediaMonarchy.com. And we are recording on May 12th, 2010. And on the line with us, but just down the road a ways, is author and podcast host of Diet Soap, Doug Lane. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I listen to the Media Monarchy every week, so I'm glad to be on your show.
Thank you. And we were just joking that we've actually now been talking without broadcasting, so to speak, for the last half hour, just kind of getting to know each other and getting going. And in several moments, we were like, hey, we should probably be recording.
Right. Well, I actually have been recording for a good portion of it, so I'll send you the recorded, you know, okay. The file.
Well, so to get folks up to date and to up to speed, can you just give kind of a brief background of yourself? So I'm in Portland, Oregon, and you are as well.
Right. I moved to Portland in 1991, right around the time that the Gulf War, the first one, was starting up. In fact, I arrived here, and the first thing I saw were big marches through downtown Portland and Pioneer Square around there, and I was very pleased to have come home when I got here and saw that. I was about 20 then, so you guys can do the math.
You're from Colorado?
I'm originally from Colorado Springs. I went to school in Florida for a little while. I ended up getting a degree at Portland State University here later in the 90s in philosophy. I'm a fiction writer. I've had short stories published in a variety of journals and magazines, national ones, you know, since 99 that started to work for me. And I have a novel coming out next year from a publisher called Tor. Tor Books is a science fiction publisher, maybe known to some people. And I also now am a podcaster for the last year.
So, and again, it's Diet Soap, and you can get it at dietsoap.podomatic.com, and you can find it in iTunes, and of course, all the links and things will be provided in the show notes on Media Monarchy for this episode. Yeah. What does Diet Soap mean?
Well, Diet Soap, yeah, it's one of those titles that doesn't mean anything at first glance, right? It is a commodity that nobody needs, but that I like to think everybody wants. But it doesn't do anything, right? Why make your soap diet soap? It doesn't have any impact. You're not eating it. Actually, is a title that has a long history. I used to do a zine in the 90s, like 93, 94, called Diet Soap. And I believe that the title was suggested by a friend back then while we were drinking beers on the stoop my studio apartment. So, you know, you should call it Diet Soap, he said, and I did, and I have.
Well, and, you know, and I think it's one of the, it makes you wonder what it's about. It's an interesting title that I think kind of draws you in, and it's that fun, you know, kind of playing with words. It almost makes like right. Clockwork Orange. It's like, what does that mean?
Right. Right. Yeah, well, I hope so. And, you know, but and at this point, I'm attached to it. I did the zine in the 90s, and then I started doing a zine again in around 2007, kind of a re-release of Diet Soap. It had been so long since I had done the zine originally, there was no need to hold on to the title. No one remembered it but me. But somehow I decided to continue with that, and then when I did the podcast, I thought I would tie it into the zine. At this point, we're about to do our last issue of the print zine sometime in the summer, and I'm just going to go on with just a podcast for Diet Soap in the future.
Now, one of your most recent guests was the Reverend Billy of RevBilly.com, which we recently talked to on Media Monarchy concerning Mountaintop Revival in West Virginia.
Yeah.
And you've got a ton of other interviews on there. And actually, can you maybe just tell folks what they may find in subscribing?
Well, people who listen to the Diet Soap podcast and go back through the archive, who listen to your podcast, might be interested to listen to an interview I did with Peter Dale Scott really early on. It's at like episode 6. I've interviewed John Gold of the 9/11 Truth Movement. There's a lot of people on the left, and I like to interview surrealists and artists as well. So Penelope Rosemont of the Chicago Surrealist Group was a guest on the podcast. Recently, I've interviewed James Howard Kunstler and Dmitry Orlov and Bud Hopkins, the UFO abduction researcher and abstract expressionist artist. Neil Kramer is another kind of mystical person that's been on the podcast. It's kind of eclectic, but I do tend to focus on people who are talking about what I consider to be kind of this general political, social, ecological crisis that we're in, and who have maybe different perspectives on it, but that are at least aware that we're in a crisis.
Well, and that may bring us to more of the topic of hand. But again, you know, we should tell folks, as we were talking earlier, that we've talked about Chomsky and 9/11 and JFK and Portland and jobs and our histories and all those kind of things.
Yeah.
So again, folks may get that later. They may not.
Right. Well, see how you can, you know, do some creative editing. I'll tell you what I do on the Diet Soap podcast. I have this sound effect. It's just the flipping of a tape, like putting a tape, cassette tape into a machine. And that sound will indicate to the astute listener that we're making a transition from one part of the podcast to another, either going from interview to a song or from a collage to an interview. So I'll lend you that, and you can just use that to cut it up and put it together however you
want. And I use, and you may have caught this on the show, I use the channel changing sound effect.
Right. So there you go. So just channel change your way through this thing that we're doing here.
So we've discussed kind of all of those things, but what we're here and what we really want to talk about is your project, and this is Pick Your Battle, Foraging as Revolutionary Self-Help, and this gets to the crisis that you just briefly alluded to. So you do have the video set up. That's great, and again, that'll be included in the show notes.
Mm-hmm.
But what is Pick Your Battle?
Well, you know, about 2 years ago, I wanted to write a self-help book, a surrealist self-help book, basically for myself, because I was working in a corporate job that I hated. I felt alienated from kind of the traditional modes of political engagement and activism that I'd been a part of. And I, on a lark on my live journal, said, you know, I want to write a surrealist self-help book. And a guy who's publishing a zine called Farrago's Wainscot, Darren Bradley, also a novelist, a pretty good writer, said, hey, Doug, if you write that, I want to publish it. So I wrote the first part of it. It was called How to Cut Your Life to Pieces, and it's on Farrago's Wainscot now, and you can look at it. And it turned into just a short story. I mean, I write short stories so often, it was easy for me to take the form of a self-help book and subvert it and make it, you know, kind of an anti-self-help book time travel story. So that's what I did. But it didn't require me to change anything. The whole purpose of writing a surrealist self-help book would be to help me, to make me change the way I approach my life and activism and all of that and creativity. So after doing the podcast for a year, I've been talking to people about peak oil and permaculture and projects of solidarity and kind of community independence and mutual aid. And I realized that the only way for me to write a surrealist or any other kind of radical self-help book would be for it to be a part of an action I was doing in the world. Wouldn't it just be a writing project? And I noticed that there were a lot of trees in my neighborhood that grew fruit, you know, apple trees and cherry trees and such, that just went to waste. So I thought I would organize around just collecting the food that's in our neighborhood. The fact that I kind of saw the economy falling apart at the same time was motivating me as well. And so, yeah, that's kind of how this was born. It was one kind of project, one kind of literary endeavor that I did a piece of for this zine, and then rethought, and I've decided I want to make it into something that makes me focus on the actual physical world that I'm in, my neighborhood, my neighbors, the plant life around me, as basically the foundation for a change.
Well, and this is something that we were talking about in basically our cities, at least in our American cities, that, you know, I'm from a small town and I knew I always wanted to go to a city, but I never wanted to go to Chicago or LA or Manhattan. And that Portland, I think, is kind of, for me, kind of that great fit that I like, not only being in a city where I can go see, you know, whatever favorite movies or bands may be playing, but that I can be in a city where I can, even if I'm just drinking a beer, I can drink a beer that was made here, and I can eat bread that was made here. And there are so many things just on the local level that it feels so much more of a positive thing to, you know, to have it come from the community and be in the community and for the community. And it's something, you know, that I've tried to spend more time on and try and get more focused on.
Yeah. And, you know, that kind of ethos is really strong here in Portland. That's one of the great things about Portland. And when I kind of poked my head up and looked around, I realized that in my neighborhood and in my community and in this city, there are a multitude of projects already going on around this issue of bringing the community together, around urban foraging, around mutual aid. So an example of mutual aid, there's a guy really literally four blocks up, old man, I don't know, in his late 60s, early 70s, who knows how to repair bicycles, and he puts the shingle out, and it just says free bicycle repair, and because he enjoys doing it, he will repair your bicycle. That's it. You can go, if you have a broken chain, he'll want you to replace the parts, to pay for the replacement of parts, but he will do the work for free because he enjoys it, just as an act of, it's part of a gift economy. And it's, you know, he can do that. He's in a position where he can do that. I don't know if that's the ultimate model for some sort of alternate economics, although as a kind of a quasi-anarchist, I'd like to believe that it is. But certainly, being involved in your community and offering work in your community based on being a neighbor, based on just your local connections to people, that's got to be something that is developed. Because
absolutely. And unfortunately, that's something that sometimes seems antithetical to cities. And I'll be the first to tell you that I can sometimes get into that city mode of just like, everything's noisy. Or it's, you know, you get in your straight ahead, you know, don't mess with me, you know, and you hear the noise and the people and on, and it kind of drives you crazy. But that's, you know, that's the opposite of what we need to do. And again, I'd be the first to tell you that I need to work on that first and foremost.
You know, one of the things I'm doing to try to break from that, one thing that happened to me that helped me break from that is I lost my corporate job. So I had some time.
That kind of pushed you out of it.
Yeah. So that pushed me out of my regular routine. I've been doing freelance work and such instead. But the other thing is, walking off your usual path. I mean, what I've been doing lately is just walking around my neighborhood, going into parts of the neighborhood that I haven't visited before. I've lived here 4 years, and I don't have to walk very far, 6 or 7 blocks, to be in a part of my neighborhood that I've never been, because it isn't part of my routine. It isn't taking me anywhere that is part of the economy of Portland for me. Like, it wasn't taking me downtown, it wasn't taking me to work, it wasn't taking me to a friend's house. I didn't need to go 6 blocks over this way to the west, you know. So I didn't. So now I'm just going on these random walks, and that's a part of the project too. In the 60s and 50s in France, there was a group called the Situationists International, and they developed this technique to understand Paris, because that's where they were, called the derive, or the derive, I'm not sure. It's French, you know. But all it meant was kind of a random walk, where you are letting the architecture, the built environment that you're in, direct you. You're actually trying to respond to it, see what appeals to you, what it doesn't. And rather than being manipulated by your environment to kind of experience your environment and discover it for yourself and have some sort of critical approach to it. So that's another part of what I'm doing, is just walking my neighborhoods, trying to figure out how different parts of Portland make me feel, just different parts of my neighborhoods, what's going on there, what is the built environment. That's called psychogeography, which is kind of a fancy term for walking.
I like that.
but yeah, we are often directed by just the architecture that we're in, and we don't take note of it. And taking note of it can be kind of a radical act.
And I try, you know, and again, when I'm walking to the bus or trying to get back to work or any of those things, you know, I have my regular path. But I do feel like I do try and deviate from those and say, well, I've never turned right here. I can turn right here. I'm still heading towards my, you know, my destination. And even if it's maybe one block, you know, I do feel like I try and do that every day, is try and veer off and go someplace different that I haven't seen. And a lot of times it isn't, you know, it isn't out of a, like, I want to explore. It's sometimes just something makes me turn, or if I'm trying to catch up to the, say, the bus, or, you know, cut it off at the pass, or, it, you know, it may be for any number of reasons.
There was a time when I was first reading about all the, all the evidence around 9/11 back in like 2006, when I I tried not to take the same route twice to anything, because I figured if I was being followed, I didn't want to let people know. I wouldn't want to be so predictable. So that was kind of
that.
Yeah, that's a little crazy, but and I knew it. You know, I let myself be paranoid like that, but I knew that there was no grounds for it. And please don't have me locked up. But anyhow, yeah. But I understand that. But the thing about psychogeography is that you're not just deviating or rearranging your usual route. You don't have a destination. That's the whole point of that. You don't know where you're going to end up. And they would, the situationists would go on these random walks for days or weeks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You know, I don't know to what extent they were out in the city without, you know, a bed to lie down on, or exactly the whole story there. But, yeah, they would just wander and let themselves be directed, and they made these maps, which are really interesting to look at, where they would draw arrows from one part of the city to another to show a psychological connection between two geographical points that weren't connected directly. It's interesting. And the most interesting thing about it is that it allows you to see how your experiences are kind of constructed for you by urban planners and economic planners and so forth.
You know, I've always enjoyed seeing, and I remember really first noticing this at my college campus, that, you know, they would build the buildings and there would be the sidewalks that would run along them, but you would see the paths that people would take on their own, because you would look at it and say, well, I'm not going to walk that long sidewalk all the way around when I can just cut right through here to get where I need.
Right.
And that it's that kind of thing that you would look at it and say, why don't we wait to build that stuff and see where people are naturally going to walk, and then maybe make a sidewalk there, or don't.
Right. That you could find this kind of paths of self-direction. That maybe they were shared by many people, but it was kind of this natural path that was there based on the architecture that had not been laid down by the planners.
So when we were talking earlier about, you know, 9/11 and JFK and these big kind of seminal events that, you know, as things progress or digress, perhaps, that may, you know, that 9/11 maybe isn't the sharpest tool in the drawer to expose folks to what maybe is really going on, because we've kind of said that even if, you know, someone had the full realization that either 9/11 was an inside job, or of course JFK was the result of a conspiracy, that you're still going to have to go to work in the morning, you still got to pay that rent, so that these maybe aren't things that are going to make people make a change to their life. But when we're talking about where we live and what we eat and who we're next to and all these things, those are going to be the fundamental, you know, actions.
Right. And, you know, here's the thing about that is, on the one hand, I remember I had a conversation with Chomsky years ago when Diet Soap was brand new, during the first iteration of Diet Soap. And I asked him what he thought the role of psychedelics and the deeply personal was in politics, whether or not he thought this was something that could help people break from the capitalist, corporate, oppressive, hierarchical order that they lived in. And he basically was of the opinion that it was a distraction, and that there was a lot of effort being made to keep people out of the public realm, to keep people focused on their private, personal, insular, very close-up lives. And so the danger when you focus on your own community, your own house, your own neighborhood exclusively, is that you'll lose sight of wanting to engage in the public realm. And what I'm trying to do with the book is say, look, not only do I want to connect to this part of my life, which is neglected, but I want it to be where power lies. I want our personal communities, our small-scale communities, to have political power and decision-making ability to create, to produce our lives from here. So that would require, on some level, engaging with the bigger, larger structures of power. But I'm not sure how, but I want to start with some firm ground under my feet, rather than jumping into the media sphere or something and taking on a big event like 9/11 or something mm-hmm. like that.
Well, and I still definitely believe, and I think it's what I, you know, try and do, is that, you know, we'll be the change that you want to see in the world. And mm-hmm. be the change you want to see, vote with your dollar, you know, and try your best to not give money or power or any, you know, psychic love to those things that we know are destructive. And again, it's a constant daily battle.
Yeah, and it's one that I think being self-critical as you go along is will be necessary and helpful. And because I feel conflicted often about just how to walk this walk, how to be that change. Mm-hmm. But one person I've talked to recently for the podcast that hasn't been put online yet is this woman, Shannon Hayes. And she wrote a book called Radical Homemakers. About basically domesticity and being a housewife and how that can be a radical act. It's kind of connected to this transition movement and to the homesteader movement. But for her, the big thing that makes it a radical act is if you break from the extractive economy, this economy that always wants to grow and dominate every aspect of your life, and try to be as self-sufficient as possible, that in itself, and connecting to your community and to your neighbors and caring about what you do at home, you know, things like canning, growing your own vegetables, trading with your neighbors, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. that all this is really a radical act because it breaks from the corporate, extractive, growth-oriented spectacle of our society.
Mm-hmm. And again, it's for me a constant battle. So on the one hand, I could say, well, I don't drive a car, so I don't pay for oil, and I don't, you know, use some of these other things, but I smoke cigarettes.
And... well, let's not, we're all sinners, as Reverend Billy would say. So, you know, we forgive each other for our sins. No, I try not to make, it's not for me, it's not about like some sort of moral code. It's not rule-based. It's not like no one should drive a car or no one should smoke a cigarette or anything like that. It's have I done what I feel is most empowering for me in my life? And am I conscious of this extractive economy and trying to disengage from it? You know, no one's going to be perfect. And that's the whole thing about kind of this lifestyleism approach to it. It's like, oh, well, if you just recycle enough and you just have, you know, a good enough garden, and you just drive a hybrid car, don't drive a car, have the right kind of bicycle or the right kind of shoes or whatever, then you'll be free. And it's like, no, you can't. It's not just a matter of making those kinds of choices. It's a matter of saying those kinds of choices, the kind of community I'm in, that should be central to our society. So like Reverend Billy is a good example of the kind of person that's really pushing this well. His church of life after shopping. You know, I want to be a part of that church. I want to have a life. I want to have a life after shopping. And actually, I would love to be as powerful a performer as Reverend Billy. I have this idea for how I want to, where I want to go with this project. And part of what I want to do is dress up like, because I'm a science fiction writer. So I want to dress up like a time traveler, take fruit that I've picked in our community into a big grocery store, supermarket. And go around to people and say, I have fruit that, you know, this grows on trees. I'm a time traveler from the future, and I'm here to tell you two things. One, I know you don't believe I'm a time traveler because you don't believe that there is such a thing as the future. And two, we don't have a future. But I'm here. I'm here from the future. Yes, you do. And secondly, food is free. It actually grows on trees. I picked this outside the supermarket and offer it to people. And to kind of push this idea of a free food economy in a creative way.
I like that. But, you know, and I instantly even think it's like most people wouldn't take it because they would think you're a nut or that's poisoned or it's, you know.
Right, right. Yeah, but it would be, and maybe I should get someone who's an actual actor or skilled at this to do it, but I may end up, you know, dressing up like a, I don't know, like Doc from Back to the Future or something.
There you go.
And doing this because I just think it would break through to be creative about it and also to be a little confrontational about it, to say, look, the food that's growing in our communities actually challenges the food economy we're in. These things are opposed to each other. This is not the way we are getting our food now. Can't last. Isn't good for you, and it's disempowering to you.
Mm-hmm. And, well, I mean, you mentioned Doc Brown from Back to the Future. When he comes back at the end of the first film, you know, the new time machine has been updated to run on
garbage
and right. Food waste.
Right, yeah. That's true.
But I think you hit on it, though, as far as, like, culture jamming, street performance, you know, satire, mm-hmm. that those are really amazing tools rather than going out and saying either, you know, the end is near, you're going to hell, or 9/11 was an inside job, or any of those kind of sloganeering things.
Right.
The satire is such an amazing tool.
Right. I think so. And it's fun.
that's true.
Yeah. If you do it well, it can be fun. The problem with that kind of performance is that it's like stand-up comedy. I suppose you can bomb, and that's why it's a little hold off on that. But, this is something I'm planning. I have to figure out how I'm going to do it and basically work up the courage, which means getting enough people around me who will support my foolishness to do this. But the other thing I wanted to say about it, about this free food economy idea, was that another kind of source for this idea is back in the 90s, I used to read anarchist magazines all the time, and I actually still do now. And there was an article about this idea of an abundant city where everyone had just spent their time and energy planting fruit trees and edible plants everywhere. So parks and medians and everywhere you looked, there would be edible plants. And that's this utopic kind of vision I have. I don't know how doable or technically feasible that is. I think it's probably more feasible than we would think at first glance. But that's the kind of the utopic vision I have behind the whole project is let's live in an economy where, and in a city where at least part of our food is completely free and openly democratically available to everybody. We could all work on community gardens. We could all work on planting fruit trees everywhere we, you know, there's a space for them. And that would be really ecological, I would imagine. And it would liberate people because a good portion of their food wouldn't be under lock and key. You know, it would just be freely available.
And, you know, and again, this I wonder about this sometimes, even, you know, for myself and for the community and maybe for the country at large. Is something like this going to keep growing naturally, or is it something I wonder that is it only going to happen when the shit hits the fan and people have to put gardens up and we're going to keep going along our merry way until we absolutely have to do that?
I think the shit has hit the fan. I think the question is it going to happen even at all now that the shit has hit the fan? Because, you know, what percentage, 20% in real terms, 20% of the population is unemployed? I know that you are skeptical about the idea of peak oil, but I'm relatively convinced if it isn't happening now, it will, because, you know, oil is a finite resource and we're using it in this indiscriminate way. So basically we're not using it rationally at all right now.
We only need to look at the news to see that it's
right. I mean, yeah.
Not being used at all, or, yeah, that it's killing us.
Yeah, I mean, is that junkie behavior or what? offshore drilling. I mean, it's so crazy. I mean, we're so desperate to fuel this economy.
It will stick the needle in anywhere.
Yeah, up our butthole.
I think that vein, under my eye still.
Right. Yeah, right. So, this is an extractive economy which isn't rational and which produces useless garbage, which is designed to fall apart in a couple of months. So we'll have to buy more.
Yep. Ending is better than mending, in the Brave New World.
Right. So, this is a junky culture. It's out of control. The question is, and we are feeling its effects. We're like, if we were alcoholics, we would be blacking out every day. So now the question is, are we going to look ourselves in the mirror and have that moment or not? I don't know.
Well, and those are the big questions. But I mean, and that's what's been interesting that's to use a terrible kind of glib sounding word. Oh, it's sure these oil spills sure are interesting. What I'm saying is the amount of, just kind of earth changes and environmental, events and catastrophes that are big in the news and are catastrophic, whether that's mining accidents in West Virginia or mining accidents in China or tornadoes and floods in Tennessee or this spill in the Gulf. But we still sometimes don't talk about, the food and the GMOs and the poisons in the water. And it seems like these events that, of course, get massive coverage just kind of fit into the narrative. So we're talking about offshore drilling and then we have this oil spill. We're talking about energy, independence or dependence, and we have these mining disasters. It seems like they seem almost, they're well-timed events to be exploited and used to kind of further consolidate the agenda as it goes forward.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing about that is, regardless of whether something like the oil spill was constructed, done intentionally or
I'm not trying to claim.
Oh, I know you're not. But let's say that, the thing about it is that even if it's just done by accident, which I believe, I know that's the case in this case, it will be used by the power structure as it exists. And, that every single crisis that happens right now is simply reinforcing the power structure that currently exists. There's always a danger that the crisis will spark some sort of reaction against the power structure that's causing the crisis. Mm-hmm. But currently, every single major catastrophe, every single crisis is used to solidify the power structure that's pushing the crisis.
So that's order out of chaos. That's something, that these families or bloodlines or organizations or corporations or all of those things, mm-hmm. they've always kind of said, we're gonna create order out of chaos. Now, whether we create that chaos ourselves, like we said, mm-hmm. it just happens. We're going to use it regardless.
Right. But the other thing that I listened to the other night, this documentary called Call It Sleep. It was actually a kind of a propaganda film from a pro-situationist person in America made in 1980. But, I'm part of this situationist cult. I should just say that right out front. I'm very big into Guy Debord and the situations. So, this guy said, the society of the spectacle, which is the society we're in, this extractive economy, this junky culture, will always present its own demise as a natural catastrophe. So the other side of that is these catastrophes that are happening, the escalation of one crisis after another, also indicates that there's a movement to rationally change the system. There is a response in people to move away from this economy, from this social structure, from these conspiracies, from all of it, and to find a better, smaller scale, human scaled, decentralized way of living. And you can't get on the one hand they're using every crisis to solidify their power, on the other hand the more they have to do that the weaker they probably are. I think they're weaker than they've ever been right now,
and that I think that fits right in with the junky analogy that you need more and more of a hit just to get to that level.
right
So let's actually, let's get into specifically, and maybe as we start to wrap it up here, okay, into what the project, the Pick Your Battle project that's on now Kickstarter, I guess is,
yeah,
I'd never seen a site, Kickstarter.com. They basically let you set up projects to fund in a way, like a chip in or something like that.
Yeah. Kickstarter, is a online platform to fund creative projects. They've helped people fund, films, books of journalism, art projects, you know, like, installations of art, in public spaces. They actually help people set up schools, like alternative schools, cooperatives. And you, what you do is you apply, you say, I have this project idea that I want to get funding for, and then if they like the idea, they'll put you on their site. And then you ask for pledges. So you set like a financial goal, a target, and you set up the amount of time, up to 90 days, that you want to have in order to reach that target. And if you do reach the target, you get your money. You get the people who pledge will pay, and you'll get the money, and you'll make the project happen. And everybody who pledges will get some sort of reward. You set up a reward system. So, like, in my case, you can get for $1, you can get a copy of my short story, Noam Chomsky in the Time Box. And for $9, you can get a PDF of the book when it's done. And $15, it's the book itself, and on. I think if you send $1,000, you get a little piece of my soul. So yeah, it's very nice. You know, wrapped in plastic and shipped out to you. So, yeah, it's... that's the funding platform, and I'm doing fairly well right now, getting a lot of people pledging, but I'm trying to get to this goal of $6,000. That will pay for the printing of the book, the distribution of the book, organizing efforts, so like leafleting and that kind of thing, for organizing both protests like the one I mentioned, and also more often foraging efforts and community walks and that kind of thing. And also give me time, some of it will go to living expenses, just to give me time to really focus on writing the book. So I'm asking people who are listening to this podcast, or who are listening to my podcast, or in any way aware of it, to chip in a buck or something, to the Kickstarter, page. And there's a link from my website, and there's a link from dietsoap.podomatic.com, and from my Facebook, and I'm pretty much a whore about it.
Well, you almost, in a way, kind of have to be. Just
yeah,
to,
right.
You want to, you know, make sure you're connected and reaching out as many ways as you can.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's a really good. I mean, I'm excited by this project because while I've been writing fiction for a while, and I enjoy that, and that's a worthwhile thing just for to have a mode of expression. This is something where I feel like I could maybe have a bigger impact with my creativity, and I'm excited about that.
And this would tie into, you know, the community here, you know, your own community. And again, that's, you know, whenever we talk about any of these stories, you know, it's not exclusive to where we're talking about. These things are and will and could and should happen all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
But when we're talking about, you know, Portland and talking about the community here, it's going to, you know, this project is going to involve other already running organizations in Portland.
Yeah, like the Portland Fruit Project is going on. There's an urban gleaning project that's going on. There's an organization that does that. There's this group called City Repair. And I've asked for pledges. What's happening is I'm getting people emailing me saying, hey, you've got to go talk to that person. You've got to go to get involved with this organization over here. And so it's going to be, as far as learning how to do this stuff and getting involved in the urban foraging aspect of it and connecting to your environment, people are doing that all over. I'm going to be able to meet a lot of really interesting people, and that part's going to be easy. I think the more difficult part will be the getting arrested as a time traveler and Safeway part, but also the connecting to your neighbors and making it something that is... It's not just, I'm a part of this nonprofit organization over here, and on Tuesdays or twice a month we do this, but I've connected to my neighbors, and we're doing this together, and this is going to lead to a different kind of relationship in our lives, just kind of every day. Because the goal of it is not to find a place in the current system to dwell, but to change everyday life.
Hmm.
And it's a big goal, and I don't expect to do it with one book, but.
So again, for folks who are interested and again, hopefully activated and energized by these kind of discussions, again, all the information will be included, in the show notes and things. And I've enjoyed talking to you. I imagine we could probably keep chatting on and on.
Yeah, we could. I should have you come on and do the Diet Soap podcast. Right now I've got a bunch of interviews stacked up, but if you want to be a guest on the Diet Soap podcast in, July or August, that would be great.
I'd love to. We could kind of continue this conversation.
Yeah. One question, I know that we're probably closing out. I should say thank you very much for having me on.
Oh, man. My pleasure.
But I want to ask you, what is it that convinces you that peak oil is not a legitimate concern?
Oh, I don't know. I guess that's, and again, as we were joking earlier, it's like, I guess I probably have a lot of shit on my show that I don't remember everything I say.
Right.
I don't know if at this point I could say that I don't believe it. At the time I was becoming familiar with it, it seemed like another kind of put up situation. But I think at this point I would say it would far more believe in peak oil than disbelieve.
Yeah.
I don't feel like it's, and actually, as we kind of mentioned it, I don't feel like it's something I've mentioned or gone over or discussed on the show, anytime recently.
The problem with all this stuff, whether it's global warming or peak oil, is the question always is, how is it being framed? So let's say that global warming is true. If the remedies for it just re-entrench the power structure as it stands, with this carbon trading and mm-hmm. that kind of nonsense, then you can pretty much, it doesn't matter whether or not what the people who are behind that remedy are, if the problem is true, that doesn't mean the remedy is good. And if you kind of keep that in mind, that you want an actual remedy, then that will help be helpful. Like 9/11 is another example. Let's say it's true that Osama bin Laden was responsible and that the Al-Qaeda was not, Al-CIA'da. If it was true, the remedy that we were given for 9/11 was terrible. We're going to go bomb a country that mm-hmm. was maybe had some of the people who were involved in this group there. But why don't we just extradite bin Laden, first of all? Do some mm-hmm. intelligence work. Do some police work. Try to actually dismantle this. This is just going to exacerbate the problem. Yep. And everyone knew that the solution was a terrible remedy for even what the problem was as it was presented. So, I don't know.
That the cure is worse than the disease.
Yeah. After 9/11, I was beside myself with kind of trembling fear for weeks, and it was not because I was afraid of a terrorist attack. It was because I was afraid of my own government and what
Absolutely.
Might be coming.
Absolutely. I recall saying that myself to friends, we were kind of huddled around, still in that kind of shell-shocked feeling.
Right.
I'm saddened by the whole thing, but what really scares me is now what's probably going to happen.
Right. Yeah. I envision, Gestapo-like troops rounding Arabs up and who knows, dissidents of all stripes, that's where it really hit home, right? And, mm-hmm. and it didn't quite happen like that, but yet it did happen like that.
Uh-huh.
So
just in a lot of this in slow motion.
Right. Yeah.
I want to end on that sour note.
No, okay, well, you end it then. You find a happy note to end it on.
Well, I know one thing I was going to mention. We get food from Organics to You.
Oh, yeah.
It's an organization here, and I'm sure I've seen other ones pop up, and hopefully other cities are doing the same thing, and it's organicstoyou.com. They basically bring you local, fresh, organic food as much or as little and as often as you may need for however many people you have in your family. And that's some, there's folks that I've wanted to try and actually get on the show and actually, have an interview for my website.
We do that too.
Well, and I think those are those kind of positive in this city. Again, I think we're kind of fortunate. And oh God, what did I see yesterday? Some, article on MSN about, where are people moving? And Oregon is the number two location. It was just by state, But yeah. DC was number one and Oregon was number two.
Wow. Well, that's crazy because our unemployment rate is highest, second highest in the nation.
I know.
What?
Well, and you're talking, I moved here 5 years ago and I had a hard time. I can't imagine right now.
Oh, yeah. Crazy time. Well, the other thing, there's a group called Food Not Lawns. And I don't know if they're in Portland, but they're, I think there's a national organization. I think there's one in Portland where they'll help you set up your whole lawn as a garden.
And I like that a lot.
Yeah. It's going on. I mean, there's a transition movement going on right now. And it just, all these different parts need to kind of, not like they need to be centralized, but they just need to communicate with each other as best as we can. And the people are doing it, too. Podcasting is one way that people are doing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope this is the start of a friendship and more collaboration and more action.
Oh, yeah. I'd love to, you know, as I say, have you on my podcast, and we should get together since we're both here.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Doug Lane.
All right.
Thank you so much, man. I appreciate it.
Yep.
MediaMonkey.com is your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. Featuring weekly radio shows on the Portland Radio Authority, PRARadio.org, the New World Next Week video series with CorbettReport.com, plus special interview episodes, B-sides, mixtapes, and so much more. Send news tips to MediaMonarchy@gmail.com. You can make a donation or mail media to the Monarchy at P.O. Box 12165, Portland, Oregon 97212. Thanks to all the internet and community radio stations who broadcast these shows, and most of all, thanks to you. Remember, don't hate the media, become the media.